Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices for Change 2.0, the mental health podcast that's changing the discussion one voice at a time, featuring guests that will help end the stigma and keep talking mental health. And now, here are your hosts, Rebecca and Joe Lombardo.
A good morning and welcome to Voices for Change 2.0.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in this morning, you guys. We are so happy to have you tuned in and listening to us and welcoming us into your homes and your busy schedules and your whatnot, listening to our humble little show. So we're happy to have you.
Absolutely.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
That's good. So today's show is starting out on a bit of a somber note, unfortunately. If you haven't already seen it online, we were devastated to find out last night that actor Chadwick Boseman passed away.
He was only 43.
He's only 43. If you don't know who that man is, he was the titular character in the movie Black Panther. So he was Black Panther in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He played a lot of great roles on top of that. Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall. He's just an incredible actor.
James Brown.
Did he play James Brown?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yes. Yeah.
Pretty cool. You know, so he was versatile, you know, and, you know, just incredible and put his indelible mark on a groundbreaking character in superhero movies for sure. Heading up one of the most popular and successful Marvel movies in, you know, since the formation of Marvel Studios, basically.
It was a great movie. He was a great actor.
He was excellent in that role. He was excellent in, you know, anything that we've seen him in. He's been just great.
And to think, for all those Marvel movies, he was battling cancer the whole time.
Yeah, you know, that's groundbreaking. I said that word wrong, didn't I? Groundbreaking. You know, just thinking about it, he'd been battling cancer since 2016, and during the course of that time, he made not only the Black Panther movie, but he made Captain America: Civil War. He was in Avengers: Infinity War, Avengers: Endgame. You know, all these massive action movies, and, you know, the poor guy was, you know, getting chemotherapy and all this other different stuff, you know, and that's hard on a person just in general. You know, I can't imagine having to do that and also, you know, be in these massive movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's such an undertaking. You know, my heart breaks for his wife and his family. And, you know, I hope that God helps them find peace in this troubling time. You know, it's just tough.
Yeah.
It's just really tough, you know. So, you know, 2020 as a year definitely sucks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just it keeps taking and taking and taking. And, you know, I think it needs to figure out giving back sooner or later.
Yeah, it's like that meme that's going around about using 2020 as the new swear word.
Yeah. It's gotten so 2020 up in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we still have 4 months left of this garbage. So that's the biggest kick in the ding ding.
I hate to rush time, you know, because it just turns into me getting a year older and, you know, the holidays coming and all that stuff. And so I hate to rush things, but this is a year of wanting to get it over and done with.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's just,
I don't know what the holidays are going to bring this year. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Good thing I already shop online for everything.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that. You know, that's old hat for us. So, you know, the big concern there is just making sure everything shows up on time.
Right.
So, but, so yeah, so that's our little somber note discussion today.
May he rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Chadwick Boseman. You know, and that actually speaks to the topic for today's show. We are extremely honored to have the guest that we have today. We'll be covering topics we have not had the opportunity to talk about on this show, and that alone, we're very excited.
Mm-hmm.
So our guest is calling in from the lovely city of Toronto,
mm-hmm.
which Beck and I are huge fans of. We will make our way back there again one day.
As we get our passports.
Yeah, we got to get our passports again. But it is what it is.
So ridiculous.
But anyway, this is a man of many talents, and we're going to talk with him about all of his talents.
He's a new friend of the show.
Yes.
I discovered him a couple of weeks back when I was posting about looking for guests to fill in for today's spot. And I discovered him in a roundabout way, and everything he had to say really impressed me. So I thought, well, let's go for it, see if he wants to be on the show. And I was lucky enough to get him to agree to it. So we're pretty excited.
And, you know, just putting this out there, ladies, he's a good-looking dude.
Yes, he is.
I noticed this when I saw the promotional materials that Beck put together. I'm like, competition. All right. I kid. Please give a hearty welcome to the show, Mr. Asante Hatton.
Good morning. Y'all are making me smile and laugh over here, man.
Oh, you know, that's what we do. We're also really good at needlepoint.
Nice. Multi-talented.
That's right. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know, just like y'all, you know, the whole, it's been a week, I would say,
yeah.
Especially if you're a black person. So, you know, because, you know, I just retweeted something that said Chadwick Boseman was our Superman, and I think that's pretty accurate. So, and then, of course, with Jacob Blake and, you know, all the things happening. But, you know, 2020 has been a year, but we got to push through.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, and, you know, again, we're really honored to have you on the show, Asante. One thing that we haven't really been able to delve into too much is mental health in relation to race. And I personally am very excited that we get to talk about this today. Just because you don't hear about it, that, you know, not at least we don't hear about it that much, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so it's good. It's just good. It's good to have you on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we were both devastated when we saw about Chadwick last night. I was shocked. You know, I thought someone was putting me on at first. And, you know, because I'm a big comic book nerd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those movies, I got back roped into watching them. And now she's not a big comic book nerd, but she enjoys them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know. So that's it's just such a painful loss, you know. And I'm older than him. What the hell?
Yeah.
Oh man, that's wow.
Yeah. So that's It's a big kick in the jumblies.
Yeah, it really is.
So, do you have any questions for us before we jump in with the interrogation? I mean, the questions.
Maybe interrogation is not the word you want to use right now. No, but I'm good, man. I'm kind of a person who, you know, I'm mostly an open book. So I mean, let's fire away.
Awesome. Well, we're going to start with a question that we generally ask all of our guests out of the gate. Where does your mental health journey begin?
That's an interesting question. As soon as you said it, you know, it made me really think, like, not just about my own personal experience, but like my familial history, right? So I mean, you know, you could make arguments that, you know, my mental health journey began generations ago. You know, there's, you know, I don't talk about this publicly that much, but, you know, there's been, you know, let's just say traumatic events that have been happening in my family for generations. And then you think about, you know, I was born in Jamaica, raised in Toronto. But, you know, my family is Jamaican, and how did black people get to Jamaica? We talk about slavery. So, I mean, historically, we could go back a long way and really look at, you know, how trauma has kind of just been carrying over for generations. But on a more personal level, I would say, I mean, I started noticing some changes when I was in around grade six. I stopped wanting to go out with my friends as much. But I wouldn't say I was like doing badly. It was just, you know, there were some things happening in my life at that time with my father, and our relationship was like quickly deteriorating, and I was losing hope that it would ever improve. When you're about to hit puberty, you kind of like, you start gaining awareness of the world. And, you know, things start to sink in a little bit. So I think that was one of the things. And then, I had to move across the city, after my grade 8 year. And, you know, I lost a lot of my friends. And, there was a lot of isolation there. And then after my grade 9 year, my mom had a bit of a, I don't know what to call it, but all I know is a crisis line showed up at our house. And, you know, me and my brothers learned that she was suicidal, which wasn't a shock to us. And then the next, like, year and a half, 2 years, she spent in and out of the hospital. And, you know, my isolation and the things that were happening in my life, you know, compounded with that, the depression rose within me quickly, you could say. And, you know, anxiety became a real debilitating thing around that time as well.
Yeah, that's, you know, one thing that we've seen during the course of doing this show is that puberty has a massive impact on mental health. It seems like right around those years when it hits, you know, your teen years into all the way into, like, you know, your early 20s, you get all these emotions hitting you all at once. And it's funny because, like, I'm seeing now, we've talked about this on the show before. Our great niece lives with us, and she's 21 months old, and she's starting to get hit with all of her emotions. And, you know, you can see she doesn't know how to control them yet. So she flips from crying to laughing like that. And thinking about it, when we're hitting puberty and all these new emotions are coming through, and you discover the opposite sex, or, you know, for some folks, the same sex, and just, you know, you start to develop feelings for other people, and, you know, all these different things start hitting you, jealousy and whatnot, and trying to get a handle on that, you know, you get overwhelmed, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, with what you had going on, you know, dealing with your, you know, what your mom was going through and all that, it's just, it compounds, you know. And, you know, I know for us growing up, we didn't really have much of outlet or a way of learning how to cope with that. You know, it's not, it's not exactly something they teach in school. You know,
okay. Yeah,
it should be, but it's not. So, and then, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention too is, you know, you mentioned going back generations, and I guess studies have shown that I guess certain types of trauma can actually be passed down through generations. You know, it's in DNA, you know, and that's when you add that on top of everything else that you're struggling with, you know, man, it's just,
it's a lot.
It is. It really is.
Yeah. I agree with y'all. but again, you know, it's like, you know, when you're a kid, you have no idea what to do with these things. And, you know, I've been like lucky enough or privileged enough to like, you know, I got, you know, a lot of support that I didn't even realize was support back then, just in the sense of, you know, my teachers at school just made things a lot easier for me. You know, they, you know, I went to a school where there were a lot of, you know, quote unquote bad kids and kids that were like in and out of jail and, you know, kids that like every other school that they'd gone to had given up on. And so the staff at the school I went to in high school, they were very compassionate and very like understanding and had a lot of sympathy and empathy for the students at their school, and really, you know, gave a lot of leeway in terms of like attendance and showing up late and handing in assignments late and, you know, making accommodations to do tests and, you know, or do a test over if you really messed it up, you know, things like that. Which, you know, for me, just like took a huge weight off my shoulders, because I knew that, you know, if I could kind of, you know, all the homework I got for a month, if I did it, you know, if I did it late and handed it in a month late, you know, the teachers would still accept it as long as I got it in before they had to put their marks in and things like that. You know, and then, you know, supporting me sometimes with like financial things or, you know, buying me food. And so those little things, I think, that really count, you know, when folks are going through something.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome.
It's good that you can look back on that time with some positivity. That's really impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And God bless those teachers, you know, and you know, it's hard out there, you know, for the teachers, for sure, you know, and number one, I'll say really quick, they don't get paid enough.
Mm-hmm. Oh no.
You know,
oh, no.
Not remotely. They don't get paid enough. And I lost my other train of thought. it happens when you get older. So what caused you to want to advocate for the mentally ill?
You know, that's an interesting question, because like the way I went through it, like I had so much self-stigma, I think, that, you know, by the time I started to, you know, get a hold of my own challenges, when I was around, I don't know, 23, 24-ish, in that age range, when I was, you know, just exiting post-secondary school and starting to get, you know, start a real adult life, so to speak, you know, I had no intention to ever, like, talk about, you know, the hardest part of my life ever again. And then, you know, I was volunteering at an organization that it was a mental health organization, and, you know, they were starting this new program to partner with schools to have young people who have experienced mental health challenges talk to other young people in schools about, you know, their story and, you know, where they started and, you know, how they've been able to manage on their journey. So I kind of got voluntold into doing that. Cause like, I was like this really shy dude back then. and just was like, you know, I was so shy that I didn't even know how to say no. That's like where I was at. so they threw me on stage, in front of, like 300, 400 high school students, which was like, I thought all these kids were going to ridicule me, you know, cause I'm still like pretty close in age to them. Right.
Right.
At that point in time. So anyway, I went up there, I did my speech, and it went, like, phenomenally well. And, you know, if you've, like, watched, you know, my TED Talk before, the first one, Uncommon Story of Hope and Recovery, you know, like 70% of that material is actually from that talk I did originally, like 8 or 9 years ago now, or whatever it was. So it just had like a huge impact on the young people and even the adults in the room, because there were a bunch of adults in the room. And, you know, I was like, whoa, maybe I got something here. And then I did it, you know, maybe 7 or 8 more times that year. And, you know, each time I did it, I got better, and I started noticing that I was actually having an impact on young people. Young people would come and start talking to me about what they were going through, and then the teachers would also come up and start talking to me about what they were going through, or the janitor, or, you know, the whoever was in the room, the lunch lady, you know. Everyone had a story, and it was like, wow, I didn't realize this thing was so prevalent, and that so many people were struggling, and so many people were isolated, and so many people didn't feel supported. And so because of that, it was like, I need to just keep doing this. And, you know, the more I did it, the more I realized how much impact I could have. And, you know, I've, you know, been privileged enough to, like, be able to kind of, you know, make a career out of it and, you know, pay my bills by talking about, like, real things.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, very, very cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because you mentioned your TED Talk, and I had a question about it later on in our questions, but you brought it up, so I might as well ask you now. You've done 2 TED Talks. How did you get involved with that, and where can people see them?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I got involved because, you know, I kind of always wanted to do one. And I had a friend, or I have a friend, I should say, who, you know, did a TED Talk before. And, you know, what's happening there? that friend, you know, they had some contacts with the TEDx youth group here in Toronto, and nominated me for the talk, and that's kind of how it happened for me. So, I mean, yeah, a little bit of nepotism, or maybe a lot of bit of nepotism, but, you know, I'd also like to say, to some extent, I earned it, because I've just been, you know, doing a good job of doing this thing for so long, and someone noticed and said, hey, this is someone you should look out for. And, yeah, so that's how the first one happened, and, you know, I guess I did the first one well enough that someone in the audience was organizing another TEDx, you know, a few months down the line, was like, hey, we want to invite you to do one here. They wanted me to do the same thing, but I didn't want to do the same thing, so I decided to tell a different story that I had never actually told out in public before, ever. It was like the first time I had ever told that particular story in any venue out loud or to anybody, really.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, so, and that's kind of how those two things happened. So a lot of my life has been very serendipitous. You know, sometimes I don't really know how these things develop themselves. They just kind of seem to fall into my lap, and, you know, I just catch them and run with it.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
That's very cool. So would you tell us a little bit about what Cypher is and where it can be found?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even tell you about where the TEDx talks can be found. So, I mean, they can both be found on YouTube. You know, this is so terrible of me, but I forget the actual, like, titles of each one. But you throw my name into YouTube, you know, I have a pretty unique name. It'll come up. TEDx Youth Toronto was the first one, and the second one was TEDx Martin Grove. They're on YouTube, pretty easy to find. And yeah, Cypher, oh my God, Cypher is just like amazing, life-changing thing for me. Like, it's just been really cool to, first let me explain what it is before I start telling the story about, like, why I love it so much. So,
okay.
Cypher is it's a musicians and, you know, director, you know, essentially what we're doing is it's for a platform called Stories for Caregivers. And what we really want to do is we're talking about peer support from the aspect of caregiving. So we are, you know, hearing the stories of individuals who have been cared for by others through, you know, mental health and addiction challenges, or hearing from the people who are doing the caregiving of others who have or continue to experience mental health and addiction challenges. So what we do with these stories is, you know, we interview the subject, so to speak, and we hear their story, and then the musicians come in, create an original song from scratch about that story. And what we try to do is we try to get musicians from different genres. So it's like a mashup of, you know, like a rapper and like indie folk singer, and boom, they come together and create a song about this person's caregiving journey. And then we share the song with the person who's being profiled, and, you know, whoever is involved in their circle of caregiving. And, you know, we kind of get the reactions on camera, you know, and we put it all together into this episode. So each one is about, you know, 6 minutes long. So, I mean, they're long, but they're short at the same time. But, you know, you get to see, like, the progression from, you know, this person, you know, telling their story, where they've struggled. You know, the musicians come in, you know, do their thing, put together, you know, incredible songs, and, you know, the songs tell the story as the person is also telling the story through the interview. So really incredible stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that sounds really, really cool.
Yeah. I love that you're pulling in different musicians from different genres too to collaborate. Just that whole, you know, feeling of inclusiveness and stuff. And I bet it's got to make whoever, you know, you've interviewed for the story just feel really good hearing this original song that's been written specifically for them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anybody who wants to check that out, you know, storiesforcaregivers.com. So you can find it there, or you could also find it on YouTube as well. Cypher, but, you know, there's probably a bunch of other things named Cypher on YouTube, but storiesforcaregivers.com.
Cool. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. So you stay on the line, and everybody else, you're going to be listening to Kingdom by David Hernandez, and we'll catch you on the other side.
Cool.
Built a world around, giving blood and soul for the right to bear this crown. You came in like a whisper, hit me like a battle cry, breaking my defenses when you don't even try. Every little part of me says no. Every little part of me just won't let you go. Giving in to giving you control. You know the words that tear down these walls. 'Cause you're taking all of me. Take all the air I breathe. I've always had. Taking all from me. On the front lines, waging war. Confusion, what are we fighting for? White flags that I pride ignore. And we pull and we take. Ooh, is it love? ever known. Every little part of me just won't let you go. Giving in and giving you control. Just take my hand, tear down these walls. You're thinking, oh, oh, of me. Take all the
Welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. I'm Joe. She's Rebecca. She's cute as a button. Look at her just sitting there with her little grin on her face. So stinking cute. I'm a lucky dude. I'm a lucky dude. And we have on the line with us today the lovely and talented Mr. Asante Hot. Why do I keep wanting to screw up your last name? Cotton.
You know what's funny? Everyone struggles with the last name, but not the first one.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we grew up in the 80s, and so, you know, Armand DeSante was a well-known actor of the time.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So your first name's simple, man. But you know, we live in Michigan, and in Michigan, there's a place up north called Houghton Lake that is spelled similar to your last name. So I see your last name. And I know it's Houghton, and I keep wanting to say Houghton, and it's wrong.
Yeah, so the way I normally explain it to people is hot and bothered without the bothered part, so.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, like, that explanation actually came from some kids making fun of me in, like, grade 8. So that's how that came about.
But that's a great story to have for it, though.
Right.
You know. So,
all right. So a subject that we don't usually get to cover is the impact of mental health in relation to race and racism. What impact does mental health have on race relations and racism, or is it vice versa?
Hey, that's a great question. I've never actually had that one before. You know, I mean, now you got me thinking. You know, I guess the first thing I'll say is, I mean, for me, there's like an obvious impact. But you know, if we're looking at like racism going in the direction of mental health, you know, just you know, racism on like personal levels and also like systemic levels, just you know, create circumstances where folks are more likely to experience mental health challenges. You know, stress is one of the things that I don't think we talk about enough in society in terms of like the significant negative impact that prolonged stress can have on a life, you know, on somebody. And so, you know, when you know, you look at folks who have, you know, mental health challenges and experience mental health challenges, you can normally pinpoint some level of like, you know, either accumulated stress over a lifetime or an extremely stressful event or some level of trauma has occurred there, right? And so now, you know, when you bring racism into the mix, you know, it's, I think the way I like to describe racism, or I've come to start describing racism, is that experience of it is it's like you're in an abusive relationship. So if you live in a racist society, you know, it's like being in an abusive relationship. It doesn't mean that you're experiencing like racism every single day, and it's present just, well, it is present in different ways, but it doesn't mean that like direct racist things are happening to you every single day, but it is happening and you don't know when it's going to happen. And there's always this anticipation for it, and there's always this anxiety around it. And it's also getting in the way of, you know, a lot of things. So in that respect, I think there's a huge impact. But then you talk about, you know, like very direct events. You know, you have negative interactions with the police, and, you know, that makes you, like, these are the folks who are supposed to serve and, you know, protect you, like the last line of defense in society. And if you can't rely on those people, you kind of feel like, you know, who can you rely on? You feel a little lost sometimes. And not only can you not rely on them to protect you, but they might also, you know, in, you know, the worst case scenario, do the opposite of that and cause you harm. Right. So there's that piece. And then there's, you know, the piece of, you know, things like it's harder to get an apartment, things like, you know, being ignored, you know, by teachers in class growing up, and, you know, mistreated by school faculty. And so it's like, I think a lot of people think about, you know, racism from the standpoint of, you know, someone called you, you know, as a black person, someone called you the N-word, or, you know, someone, I don't know, just did some, like, screwed up thing directly to you. But it's really like, I mean, those things hurt and are damaging, but it's really those like day-to-day like cumulative effects that kind of, you know, over time make you feel like there's really like that everything is really challenging, and there's less hope for you and having a positive outcome in society, because, you know, in the institutions that you find yourself in, you realize that there are some people in those institutions that do get in your way, and there are policies that get in your way, and now you're left with this whole bag of stress trying to figure everything out all the time, trying to always navigate, and, you know, that stress, you know, gets to you. And, you know, you look at someone like, you know, as we talk about generational stuff, it's like, yeah, you know, we could go back to slavery and talk about the obvious trauma there, or, you know, even go back a few generations and talk about, you know, my grandmother, great-grandmother, and, you know, that obvious trauma. But you look at my mom and, like, you know, the stress that she's had to face, you know, the barriers she's had to face that have, you know, made it harder for her to get out of poverty, which then makes it harder for you to raise your children, which means now you're working three jobs and, you know, two or three jobs, and you're stressed out about that, which means that you're not as emotionally available for, you know, your children. And then those children aren't getting that emotional support. And those children are also, you know, scared of the police. And those children are also being disproportionately suspended and expelled from school. And those children are, you know, living in poverty because of other systemic structures. So, like, all these things really, you know, it's like you just keep piling on, and you get to a certain point, you're like, you know, you're like, damn, this is really hard and it's really challenging. That stress accumulates, and then stress becomes mental health, and, I mean, that's how we get here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really, you know, it puts into perspective for us, because, you know, I don't know if you can tell, but Beck and I are white.
I got that impression. And,
okay, that's good. I'm happy you did.
Yeah.
And, you know, for us, you know, we haven't had to experience a lot of the same things that you and your family have gone through, you know. And I think with everything that's been going on lately, I know myself personally, I'm a lot more sensitive to it now, you know. And, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow, quite honestly, you know, my heart breaks because knowing that, you know, you walk around all day and you're hyper vigilant, and you know, you don't know if you can rely on, you know, the police or, you know, the courts or anything like that for a situation that you might have going on, and that one little thing can flip the script on you. You know, that's like being in a slap fight with a friend, and you know it's coming, you have no idea when it's going to happen, and then just boom, one day it hits you out of nowhere, you know. And so yeah, I just,
yeah, you know, I think that's like what a lot of white folks are really experiencing in 2020, because I mean, you know, with George Floyd's murder, and I mean, obviously, and y'all are probably feeling it more because you're in the States, right? But up here, we're talking about these things a lot too. But George Floyd's murder, then, you know, you go to, you know, Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, and then, you know, all the names, you know, that have happened since and then before. Anyway, there's a lot happening. And I think that, like, it's really front and center right now in a way that, you know, maybe a lot of white folks didn't, like, see or pay attention to before. And I could imagine that's a hard pill to swallow, you know what I mean? In the sense, like, maybe there's some, like, guilt and shame and, you know, all those things that come along with it. But it's also, you know, good to hear, you know, you acknowledge, like, the hypervigilance of being a black person, because that's actually what it is, you know, my safety is within my home, or, you know, the home of my loved ones, or the home of my friends, or in spaces where, you know, most of the people in that space look like me, because otherwise I don't actually feel safe in society, like walking the street. I'm like, actually always like knowing where, like what's happening in my surroundings, and, you know, who's looking at me, and, you know, because, like, these are the things that, like, happen. Like, people are always, like, staring at you and, like, giving you accusatory looks and, you know, looking at you like you're a threat. I'm also, you know, I'm 6'4", too, right? So that's another piece. So I'm, like, I'm a pretty big guy, right? So people look at you like you're a threat. They're afraid of you, like you're suspicious. Like, you know, why are you in this store? Why are you in this area? What are you doing here? So it's like you get this every single time you leave your house. And, you know, it's part of you gets used to it, and a part of you is always annoyed by it. And, you know, if it just looks whatever, well, not whatever, but, you know, it's when those looks translate into action, which then becomes discrimination. That's when things get real shaky. And, you know, when you kind of put that, you know, in the context of, you know, law enforcement, you know, it's easy to see why, you know, when bias isn't seen as a threat or scary or untrustworthy, that, you know, officers who have that kind of bias react the way that they do. And then, you know, you get shot 7 times in the back, even though you haven't actually, like, done anything to require that level of force.
Right.
Against
exactly.
You, right? You know, and I've been arguing with folks on the internet for the past 2 days about this, which I shouldn't do. It's not a productive use of my time, but, like, I need to get it out.
Yeah. No, I get that. It's this whole thing that's been going on, it's having an effect on everybody. I saw on Twitter yesterday that Jim Gaffigan, comedian that is just the most mild-mannered dude you ever met and just most family-friendly, finally lost it on Twitter, and he was even cursing at people. So it's having an effect on everybody.
Everybody.
I actually have a question for you from our producer, Scott. He wants me to ask. He says, most white people take for granted that our history is being taught in school. Do you feel the same for the Black experience? And if not, what does your community do to make sure your history is passed down?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great reflection, because I think that's one of the challenges, I think, of, like, that white folks are experiencing right now, is, like, realizing that, like, whiteness has become so normalized that you're, like, that everything else has kind of, you know, not, you know, been able to take the stage, right? So mm-hmm. when, you know, the stories of the Black experience, or the stories of, you know, the Native American experience, or, you know, the Asian American experience, or what have you, you know, when those stories aren't being told, it becomes easier for us to form these very narrow lenses and viewpoints on how we view individuals or the communities that they come from, right? So for myself, you know, like, thank God I had a mother who was, like, you know, kind of a bookworm and, like, into history, and, like, you know, she went to school for it. It's, like, her favorite thing. You know, she was always watching, you know, educational kind of TV at home back when, like, A&E showed, you know, and TLC showed things other than reality TV shows. right? So,
yeah.
Like, the History Channel, right? You know what I'm saying? So, I just grew up with all this, and my mom was constantly trying to make sure that I didn't look at my Blackness as a burden, and constantly trying to make sure that, you know, the same for me and my brothers, that, we didn't look at our Blackness as something negative, or something that, you know, needed to be changed or accommodated for or anything like that. And also, you know, taught us a lot of history at home, you know, put us in, you know, some, like, after school Afrocentric programming and things of that nature. So, I mean, despite all of that, I mean, I would be remiss to say, you know, I think I'd be wrong to say that, like, some of these, like, racist images that we see on TV didn't, like, infiltrate and, you know, get past the walls of the fortress, so to speak. But, you know, I think, you know, with the teaching and the learning that, you know, I had at home, it really provided, you know, a strong buffer and, you know, defense against the normalization of whiteness. Because when whiteness becomes normalized, you know, you look at everything else as not normal, and then it's otherized, and, you know, it's either exotic or unacceptable, or in some way just not the thing to be or the thing to want. And, you know, I grew up, like, for me, it was like, growing up, how Black could I possibly be? That was, like, my thing. It wasn't like I was trying to, like, reduce my Blackness. I was trying to increase it, and, you know, in a predominantly white society, which was, you know, because Toronto's a very diverse city, you know, nowadays in 2020. But, you know, I grew up in Toronto in the 90s, and in the 90s it was not very diverse. So there were a lot of challenges there in terms of, like, maintaining your own identity in a society that not a lot of the people look like you. But I feel like I'm rambling a bit, but I guess,
no, you're fine.
I guess for me, I had the luxury and the privilege of just having a mother who just had a lot of knowledge and was curious and dedicated to learning and then passing that down to us. You know, one of the, like, tragic things I'm learning, you know, talking to my friends more, like, about their experience growing up. It's funny. We kind of assume that we have a lot of similar experiences when you're Black people, but, you know, we've been talking a lot more about, like, our experiences growing up and stuff like that. And I'm talking about it in a lot of, like, forums and community circles and things of that nature. And, you know, there's a sentiment that, like, I'm learning. I'm not even sure if I should say this, if I'm, you know, telling too many secrets, but, you know, that I'm hearing a lot. You know, for real, because, like, a lot of Black folks were like, yeah, you know, keep that stuff in-house. But, you know, what I'm learning is there is, like, a lot of Black folks that I met recently who at some point, you know, whether it was to avoid discrimination or racism, whatever, but, you know, there was a point where, you know, whiteness was something that they wanted to move toward, whether changing their skin color or, you know, in terms of, you know, culturally, et cetera, whatever. And, you know, well, yeah, you know, essentially that, you know, at some point, you know, there are some Black people who wanted to be white because of, like, how hard it is to be black. And, you know, I think one of my privileges is that I've never actually felt that. I've always, in fact, I've wanted to be like darker skinned than I am now. That was like actually how I grew up. I was like, damn, I ain't dark enough. and you know, I think a lot of that really came from my mom and like the, just the kind of values she instilled and, you know, making sure that, you know, me and my brothers look in the mirror and, you know, feel good about who we are. Just because of that is, you have to love who you are. If you don't, I mean, the world becomes a very challenging place.
Yeah, that's for sure. We're gonna skip a couple of our questions because we're getting
Sorry,
low on time. But
much?
We want.
Am I talking too much?
No,
Sorry.
No,
good.
No. We it's funny because you know once in a while we'll get guests that will give you one word monosyllabic answers like yeah, no, and it's just like it's like pulling teeth trying to get anything out of them. So no, by all means, don't shut up.
All right, cool.
We do want to shine a spotlight on something you're involved in, which is the Reach Out Response Network. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the Reach Out Response Network is, you know, I'm not even sure what to call it right now. We're kind of an advocacy group, you know, started by myself and my co-founder, Rachel Bromberg. You know, a lot of respect to her. And what she's been able to do, I mean, essentially, you know, she calls herself a mobile crisis nerd. And, you know, her passion is, you know, how do we help folks who are going through, you know, a mental health crisis or, you know, some other mental health related, you know, some form of crisis within that realm of things. How do we help provide them with service that is safe, relevant, accessible, and gives them, you know, a positive outcome beyond they didn't get hurt. So she's been doing research on this for a couple of years now. Approached me about it about a year and a half ago. I said, this is a brilliant idea. You need to do it. And then she's like, would you help me out? And I was like, yeah, I'll help out. So, you know, that's kind of how it all started. And, you know, again, you know, she's been trying to, you know, put things together for a year and a half. And then, you know, 2020 happened and, you know, obviously, you know, with George Floyd down there, but also up here in Canada, we've had, you know, like a series of deaths occurred during mental health wellness checks in which law enforcement were the first responders. So those things were happening right around the time George Floyd was murdered. So a window of opportunity opened in terms of a conversation around, you know, obviously racism, but, you know, thinking about mental health and law enforcement and, you know, crisis response and what do all these different things look like. And here in Toronto on June 30th, the city of Toronto voted to, I guess, take a different look at what mental health service or crisis response can look like in Toronto. You know, we wrote an opinion piece to one of the big newspapers here in Toronto, the Toronto Star. That got a lot of momentum. And, you know, all of a sudden we just had like an organization and, you know, that this like happened all over the last, you know, today's August 29th. So yeah, this has been happening over the last, you know, 2 months, essentially, where we've gone from like an idea to now, you know, having a website, reachouttoronto.ca, you know, a bunch of volunteers who are, you know, ready to work with us, over 200 volunteers, you know, really starting to really organize and trying to make something happen here in the city. You know, of course, the big thing, the big challenge is always resources and funding, and we're trying to figure that piece out. And, you know, I think, you know, we have a great idea on our hands, and, you know, we're starting to turn that idea into data and put reports together. And, you know, with that data and those reports, we're going to, you know, build a implementation plan and a model, and, you know, we're going to keep knocking on the door to essentially see if we could, you know, get the support required to at least inform, you know, what, you know, the revision of, you know, medical crisis. like.
Wow.
So, that was a mouthful, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but that's quite an undertaking, and it's cool that, you know, you guys have gotten such great momentum on it in such a short period of time.
Yeah, for sure.
Love to see something like that down here in the U.S. I think we need it,
mm-hmm.
For sure, with everything that's been going on.
Yeah, I think we all need it, for real.
Yeah. So.
Well, we're coming to a close here with our time with you. So really quickly, we just wanted to offer the opportunity to talk about your social media pages with our listeners so that they can come check out and see what you're up to next.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone who wants, you know, I'm on Twitter and Instagram mostly. So on Twitter, my handle is ASANTE, capital V, Asante V. On Instagram, it's nerdy.black.guy, which I think is, you know, saying a little bit too much. but yeah, that's where you can find me. I'm often posting about, you know, social justice things, mental health related things, and, you know, sports. And every once in a while, you get some funny jokes and memes. So.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for being with us today, Asante. We'd love to have you back anytime.
Absolutely.
You are absolutely a new friend of the show and hopefully a long-term friend of the show. And, you know, if there's anything new coming up down the line, we definitely want to highlight it. And personally, we look forward to getting to know you a lot better outside of the show. So stay on the line. Everybody else, you're going to be listening to The Real Me by Kenneth Mogan. And we hope you have a great week. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Wear your mask. Dance a jig. Whatever.
We'll see you guys next week.
We'll see you. Have a great week.
To hide, didn't think I was worth it. Words stuck in my mind like a crescent moon in the night sky. You're my light in the darkness. It's time to tie your hand in mine. Never thought I'd find this. I've been waiting my whole life. The shadows, the spark that gives me life. Your love took all my sorrow and made everything alright. Like a crescent moon in the night sky, you're my light in the darkness. Side by side, your hand in mine. Never thought I'd find this. I've been waiting my whole life. Later.
as well as on his Twitter account. And I think that really plays down whatever gap or mistake that Joe Biden makes.